So while you guys are sitting down, since you're in the room, we'll just start. We'll just start the meeting. You want to call the roll?
Anderson
here.
Taglia
present.
Ensel
here.
Cotman
not here.
Carews
not here.
None of the boys are here. Not here.
Hey, Guido.
He's here.
Howard
here.
Kaufman
here.
Kim
here.
Cruiser. Hello. Michael
here.
Quinn.
Oh,
Shot
here.
Bailone.
He's here.
Wiggers
not here.
He's not.
Bonarto
here.
Great. Thanks so much. So the next item of business is a call for late additions. Are there any late additions to the agenda? No? All right.
Team, do announcements have to be added?
Like
you have yours.
Yeah.
Your committee?
Yeah. You like your CIC announcement?
Oh no. Okay.
So are there late additions to the agenda? No? Okay. Then we'll move into the consensual relationships policy committee. Before we do that, though, I actually want to say, since we are running pretty short on time, I'm going to enforce a 30-minute speaker time, or a 30-second speaker time. That wouldn't work too well.
I got you.
So if you have a question, try to answer, try to get it out in 30 seconds, and if you are responding, try to get it out in 30 seconds. So, yeah, we can see how that goes. Thanks. All right. So with that, Charlie, thanks so much for being here.
Okay. Yeah. So the emphasis here on rough draft. Here's where we are. After tomorrow, we'll visit every assembly and run by this rough draft. There'll then be sort of like a 1 month public comment period, and then all the assemblies, including this one in the Senate, will be revisited in April, where they will then vote on this. And the end game, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, so let's take a look. So here's the setting. So we've met a lot of times, 11. We have a website that's been up since December, where people that are able to post reactions to 10 different study questions that we gave. We've looked at policies at 50 other schools and abstracted the best parts of those. I just said we're visiting all the assemblies. We've met with all the college HR people, 20 graduate field assistants, because they have a unique perspective, various student groups, and still upcoming, we're going to meet with all the DGSs, Graduate Women in Science, and other groups. And this is a hot button issue. Everyone feels strongly about it. The same could be said with the calendar. Although this one is different, so anyway, the key thing is that people feel strongly about this, and it's very, very important to understand alternative views. So, for example, there people who feel you have the right to romance, so basically, you know, get out of my life, okay? And these are very well-reasoned arguments, living off of the Ninth Amendment and other things. And you have to understand those, no matter what your point of view is, and respect it. There's also what I would sort of call people feel that it's Title IX overboard, okay? That this particular author was brought up on Title IX charges at Northwestern simply because she wrote an article for the Chronicle of Higher Education articulating that what might be called an alternative view. Anyway, these are books, I've read these books to try to understand those points of view. Talking about this particular 1 month period, I really want to hear most definitely from people who disagree with some of our initial rough draft proposals, okay? And you can go online and look at the rough draft and comment on any of its six sections. So what does President Pollack get? From each assembly, she gets something like this, a vote and surrounding comments. Okay, those could be, you know, resolutions or chit-chat, anything the assemblies want. Those five packages go to her. And then it goes, it's between her the university lawyers and so on to actually turn it into a policy. And we're talking about a university policy at the 6.4 level. The best outcome would be that there's some kind of community consensus across the five assemblies that, yeah, you might disagree with this or that paragraph, but basically emerging from that process 1 month from now with basically this is what we kind of recommend. The worst thing would be if that submission, those five submissions were in disarray, then again, the lawyers are going to go, there's definitely going to be a policy 6.x, I can assure you that. But if it really disagrees with all the different assemblies and whatever, people won't buy into it. They'll just say this is another edict from on high. So the pressure is, well, you know, the pressure is really on to have the whole campus understand this issue, okay? So it deals with consensual relationships, okay, that are romantic and or sexual. And there are lots of different possible pairings. Here is the ones that this policy addresses. We have what we call authorities, people who can exert an academic, who can influence the academic or professional career of the subordinate. The allowable subordinates here are undergrads, grads, and postdocs. Okay? I don't want to go into details, you know, vet interns are in here and so on. Those are the allowable subordinates. Anybody can be an authority, okay? So we have staff, faculty broadly construed, the non-tenure track, tenure track, and so on, postdocs, graduate students, and undergrads. For example, you could be a coach, and you could be an authority in that particular position. You could be a grad TA, and in this class, your grading is an undergrad. Okay? You can be an undergrad grader, and in this class, you're grading another undergrad. So these are all the possible pairings. With respect to undergraduates, we're recommending a total prohibition. And here are a little bit of context. So in the Ivy Leagues, all Ivy League schools do this except Penn and Columbia. Stanford, Chicago, Northwestern, Washington University, there's a list of schools that do this. And the various reasons, if you read these policies, you'll see things like you know, undergraduates are particularly vulnerable, they lack the maturity and so on, words to that effect. We are instead living off of a principle that we all buy into and should buy into 100%, which is any person, any study. That if there's a consensual relationship out there between a faculty member and an undergrad, you are disrespecting to a certain degree that particular logo of the university. So anyway, so that's one part of our recommendation. So we're not alone. And also, when you look at cases like Rochester, if you haven't looked at that, you should. That case has not only this destroyed an apartment, the university president is gone, it has cost them millions and millions of dollars, okay? And it's interesting to look back on their sequence of revisions to their policy over the last 3 or 4 years as this case unfolded. It was made possible by a weak policy, and then gradually they're ratcheting it up. So for example, an undergrad faculty ban is now part of their setting. Then we have this other class of relationships where the authority has the ability to exercise or make decisions that affect the academic or professional well-being of the subordinate. So for example, if you're a graduate student, there would be a list like that would be prohibited, okay? Because if you're in one of those positions, you have the authority to affect the graduate student. It's a real conflict of interest. For a postdoc, for example, that's what a list of possible authorities might look like. undergraduates, I mentioned coaches, you know, grad TA and undergrad TA and so on, you have to avoid conflict of interest. So these would be examples of prohibited relationships. Let's talk about the two things now to talk about. One is what we'll call the disclosure recusal mechanism, and then also about enforcement. So here's a sample situation, okay? So you're in a field, and a graduate field, and you're having a relationship with a graduate student in that field, but you don't have direct authority over that person. You know, say they're in some totally different research area. So what you might want to do then is have a disclosure policy that protects the environment, protects the academic environment. So for example, the graduate field will routinely be evaluating all students, giving out support and so on. That faculty member should not be allowed to participate in those decision processes, okay? So you would have a recusal plan. Now it sounds like, oh geez, what's this gonna be, like a 10 pager? No, it could probably be two or three sentences. For example, every field does these things differently, that if you have a meeting where you're talking about academic progress, that faculty member does not participate. Okay, now one of the things that we're recommending is that we have more than just one pair of eyes looking at things. There's a history of stuff being swept under the rug, you know, maybe a chair or a DGS not knowing what to do. The professor involved is a big professor and so on. So you want to have mechanisms in place that not only are clear for people to follow, but that involve more than just one player. So for example, the faculty member would disclose the relationship, most likely to the DGS, who would then, you know, they would come to an agreement on how we manage this relationship. We're recommending the existence of a placeholder name here, 6.X office. You have to have something that's outside of departments, outside of colleges, outside of fields, because all those lower levels can have a vested interest. This is not a love police office. It's simply an office that can help people deal with these situations. So you could disclose to either or, say, this office or the DGS in this particular example. So again, trying to be clear on what the procedures are. If they're not clear, there's a tendency, you know, not to do anything. A little bit about enforcement. When things went down in flames in 2015 in the Faculty Senate, part of it was that this whole slide was replaced with this two words, the, I forget the name of the supervising dean. It was like everything ends up on the supervising dean's desk. You go out and have a cup of coffee with a grad student. Well, I have to send a memo to the dean about that. So there was a real police state, unreal kind of expectation about that mechanism. So we felt obliged to spell it out a little more. But again, it's just enough detail so that all the assemblies and the community can sort of see how it would work. Clearly, lots of detailed work has to go into this picture here. But it sort of would look like this. If this policy is, if it's violated, it means either there was a prohibited relationship or something went wrong with the whole disclosure recusal thing. So again, looking at how this might go, there'd be some investigation done, say, through the 6X office, but with like my office and the department chair and whatever all involved. Again, multiple sets of eyes behind every one of these yes-no decisions. If the thing involved prohibited relationships, then you're talking about recommending sanctions and it goes to the academic dean. Okay. If it just involves disclosure, then there's another fork in the road. Maybe there was no harm rendered, or there was harm rendered. And again, depending on that outcome, things would flow in a certain way. So that's about it. Let me just sort of summarize things here. And also, sorry, I can't. Okay, so here are the 4 points. Undergrad faculty ban, a carefully orchestrated plan where you don't get in, where there's relationships are not allowed if there's academic authority behind the scenes. Some kind of disclosure recusal method that's not a huge overhead routine, to be as routine as you filling out that financial conflict of interest form once a year. Right, that's what we are sort of recommending in that regard. And then this office that helps people navigate these tricky sort of waters. Now, this again is a rough draft, okay? Tons of research and thought went into it. But even in the last few days, okay, we're getting pushed back in certain directions. Let me just mention what I would think now is almost the number one pushback and something that we'll have to reconsider, especially grad students and faculty, which is that instead of this picture here, that you would have perhaps a ban on relationships that are within a field. In other words, this picture, the story behind it, is the faculty member and the student, you know, I'm not your supervisor, so it's okay. A slightly more clear policy, but more stringent, would be that all relationships between faculty member and a student in the same graduate field would be prohibited. There's strong arguments for doing something like that. Okay. Anyway, these are very tricky points, and we want to have these discussed. Okay. So.
Yeah. Great. Thanks. First Matt, then Bob.
So being brief, first off, thank you, Charlie. Good to see you again. Just briefly on the graduate field, I would caution you, I personally like the current system where it's direct supervisory authority. The law school, business school, and the larger graduate fields are so large. To have a blanket ban to me, I think, is over-inclusive. Again, we talked last night about that a little bit. And just to note for the assembly, I personally still have reservations about the blanket ban in undergrads. It sounds to me like in loco parentis, which we fought very hard to get rid of a number of years ago. Again, there seems to be dispute on that, and I don't want to rehash what we discussed previously. My question is primarily, though, for the enforcement mechanism, being that this policy is no longer just the old version, it was in the faculty handbook, is really looking heavily at faculty.
Can you speak up a little?
Speak up a little?
Yeah, just speak, because we're doing 30 seconds.
30 seconds.
I was getting to the end right now.
Okay.
And also, there's no motion to limit speaking time. So, but to get back to my question, the code, in essence, the current policy in the faculty handbook was faculty-centric. This is really university-wide. So I'm curious, for the enforcement mechanism, what thought has this given, being this put in the campus code of conduct? The Title IX exclusion from campus code, and I went back and checked, was only for sexual assault and harassment. And both yesterday's presentation, both yourself and Ms. Waymack were emphatic. This policy is not that. So I'm just curious, that's really the heart of my question.
Well, if the, you know, there's a whole set of procedures for employees, okay, for staff that's different than faculty.
Yes.
And also even within graduates, we don't fully understand the paths there, but graduate students, there are procedures for them that are sort of separate too, right? In terms of the intersection with the code, I don't know. All I know is doesn't the code have this line that it's not job related. All this stuff is job related.
It's not job related for faculty and staff. For students, it is, which is why it's a complex issue.
I don't see why it's not job related. I'm your thesis advisor, right? And I'm doing something in the context of my job. I mean, I just looked at the code and thought that one line means there's no intersection with this at all.
Well, for the faculty, I would argue yes, and I know we're looking at time. But the thing is,
if a
graduate
is, yeah, let's get to the other.
Otherwise, I'll put you on the second speaker, Glitz, but I think you were on to a good point. So, Bob.
Yeah, two question and a comment. Do you have any sense of how many cases we're dealing with, how many relationships we're dealing with? In terms of having a whole office, is that necessary?
We're talking thousands. Yeah, so there's a line in what we call the synopsis where it says this could be just one person. We don't know the volume of what's out there, how many cases. And the connection between that office and the Title IX office has to be pretty is tricky. It should definitely sit in central HR someplace. But
just a comment on your thought that there should perhaps be an absolute ban on faculty in a field having relationships with graduate students in the field. I just want to confess for the record that my wife became a graduate student in the same field I'm in earned her PhD, and so that would have been prohibited under that rule.
That's right.
Yeah, so probably would have driven us to another university, quite frankly.
That's right. Yeah, so I'm aware of but times have changed, and I want to stress something here. This is not passing judgment on situations.
No, I'm just, you know, I think that was a reasonable thing we did, and if this ban were here and were to come up again, I would take a job elsewhere.
Okay, but like the again, I'm not going to keep using this as my example. If you just think of the University of Rochester case, a department is destroyed. The professional society that sits on top of that department has a 400-person petition saying never send a student to Rochester, okay? The president had to resign. Millions of dollars. I'm not saying, I'm just putting that out there. This is, it's a new world order. Okay, and the university has to protect itself. It's part of this. It's part of this.
Marty.
Yeah, two small things. One, I think these, when you talk departments, you and some relationships with departments, there is a need to think a little bit about interdisciplinary programs as well. And they're not departments, and yet there could be faculty in an interdisciplinary program who is in relationship with someone who is in another department.
Yep.
Okay, second thing, you used the question, the point, one of your examples was somebody going out to have a cup of coffee with a grad student.
Right.
I mean, that's a little bit trivial, isn't it?
No, but there's really a huge important issue. Whatever this ends up being should not chill the environment that we know drives teaching and research, all right? There's a collegiality thing, and you don't want to shut off stuff. That was a sarcastic remark.
Oh, sarcastic. Okay, so, but I thought it was used as something that would be questionable, and therefore I had to date to just close your
mind. No, I mean, the fear is that, again, you'd have so many people would just freeze up because they're afraid to be.
I guess the thing I'm suggesting is that you have a list of possible scenarios and what seems more real than problematic. And then the third small thing was you talked about five different assemblies, you know, needing to do things. I would suggest that instead of having five documents on President Pollack's desk, we should try and work like we do with other resolutions on basing what we do on, or at least correlating what we do with others, so that there's a more of a general consensus that this is what we can do. And I don't know what mechanism could be brought about to do that. But in the case of other resolutions, we've done that.
It's a time, it's a sequence thing. So this assembly is special. So you have SA, GPSA, and EA doing things, and the Senate as well. And then, you know, a role for this assembly would be to orchestrate, to make sense of what comes out of the most different.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just a reminder, we're going to try to do like 30 seconds of like question time.
Point of information, the assembly voted that down in the past. So what authority are we basing that off of, or is it just a courtesy request?
I'm just like asking.
Okay.
So that we can get that
clarifying.
Thank you. So Rena?
So I guess looking at this chart, it seems that the department is sort of has the potential of acting as an intermediary between the affected parties and the 6.x office. So I guess, have you ever thought about like, how are departments held accountable? So say, you know, the affected parties have, you know, reported this to the DGS, but then, you know, the upper level, like chair and DGS doesn't do anything,
right,
like doesn't inform the 6.x office. So is there enforcement on the department? That's my first question. And the second one is on the recusal plan, is there a reason why the potential graduate student affected is not included in the discussion? Because I think that even when you have faculty member and a grad student in two different subfields within the department, it could be that the grad student would like to take a class in that different subfield. So is the onus on the grad student to never take that class, or should the faculty member not teach that class?
Okay, yeah, so the disclosure responsibility is with the authority.
Okay.
So, and everything goes to the 6X office, even if it's just to look at it and file it away. Okay. So, in terms of the recusal plan, I guess the examples I gave here are, you know, very, very standard things. But, you know, one of my slides there, you know, you can't have in your class you know, a partner. You cannot, you know, that's you would either have to take a different class or wait for some different professor or do something different. That's not allowed. I mean, this student cannot take a course from that person under any circumstances.
Oh, sorry. Richard.
So Charlie, one suggestion, which is you have under the absolute ban on undergraduates, you have this any study that you're borrowing from immigration. I make that words that's not immigration.
I'm getting immigration.
So that's our motto?
That's a motto.
That's Cornell's motto.
It's a principle. You come here as an undergraduate. You've got free range of a university.
It's identified with, I would put it into words. I mean, they are words, but I put it another way that explains
I would found an institution.
Any person should be spelled out what the motion to that to the rule. That's just a recommendation. I'm not doing any more.
The second thing,
I worry about privacy under your, I mean, this notion of filing a report once a year,
it might be misunderstanding. So for here's a sample thing that we're thinking. We talked to the grad school that every grad student has to fill out with their advisor, and the advisor has this, it's a progress report. What's it called? The annual report grad students have to think of this academic progress SAP. I don't want to wait.
I don't remember what it's called, but we do fill it out.
We do all the financial reports, and like 1,500 of the faculty just check it. It doesn't apply to me. 100 have to do something. A little checkbox saying, I have read and understand 6X. That's all we're talking about. It's not a heavy duty thing here. Again, for the purposes of the diagram, you see this box there, 6X office. It's not a love police thing. Okay. Let me just sort of phrase it.
No, I got it. I understand what you're saying.
You can look at this diagram two ways. You can look at it saying, get out of my life. This is my private life. Or you can say, I think enough of my colleagues and respect them enough that I want to create an atmosphere in this department or field that's free of bias, discrimination, favoritism, and so on. So there are two ways of looking at that, extreme points. And again, you can sort of say bureaucracy, being told what to do, interfering with my private life, but something is more important than that, which is the well-being of that academic.
Let me take another 10 seconds of my 30 to just think.
Can I put you on the second speaker's list? That's what I'll do. Joe.
So I have a question about like the process moving forward. What happens if, for say, the assemblies, like the faculty senate is the only like group that says, no, we're not doing this? Or what happens if the GPSA is the only one saying, no, we're not doing this? What happens then? Is it just going to be like...
Goes to, being cryptic here, Martha and the lawyers.
Okay.
There definitely is going to be written a policy 6X.
Yeah.
Okay. So what we have now is 2 weeks. That's going to happen. The idea is the shared governance idea is that everybody weighs in with a vote and perhaps comments, resolutions, whatever each assembly wants to do. That ends up in that conference room with Martha and the lawyers.
Okay.
Yeah. This isn't binding. Okay. That's why it's not like, it was an 11-10 vote. Whew. All right. No, it's like, I don't care what the vote is. It's the totals and all those comments that go with it. We would have loved this proposal, except we were so much against the undergrad ban, we voted no. Okay. So stuff like that.
Okay. Can I ask a quick follow-up?
Can I put you on the second speaker?
Yeah. Please?
Yeah.
I'll be nice.
I appreciate you asking. That was nice. Chris?
Yeah. So I had a
I don't know if it's a concern to your justification for prohibiting relationships between undergrads and faculty. It seems that by engaging in a relationship with faculty that's, you know, way outside of your field, first of all, I feel like the nature of the relationship, apart from the age difference, wouldn't be different from a graduate student being in a relationship with a faculty way outside of their field. And that, you know, in engaging in such a relationship, you're consciously, like, not abdicating, but, you know, giving up your right to maybe take classes within that department. So I don't know how strong the justification of any person, any study is if the, you know, by entering into a romantic relationship, the student is kind of giving up their right to take a class with that professor. It's kind of almost implicit in entering that relationship.
Well, first of all, the any study thing, properly worded, is a high-level philosophical thing, okay? But there are also practical reasons here. How likely is it for a professor to disclose a relationship with an undergraduate compared with a graduate? Okay, think about that. Think about alternative course-taking plans, and the relationship goes south. Now this professor is, and so that the student cannot abide being taught by this person. This is a required course. I'm a senior. It's either this or I don't graduate. How do you rectify that? It's much more doable in the grad studies to rectify things like that. So there are actually practical reasons behind this as well. And again, clarity is really important here. These are called bright lines, all right? And that clarity, it is felt, the committee feels, would inspire ethical behavior more than having something that's fuzzy. So those are some of the reasons.
Yeah. Okay, so I think everyone who's wanted to be on the speakers list once has had an opportunity to speak. And also we've exhausted the time. So I'm basically gonna, like, but there are four people on the second speakers list, so I'm gonna let the assembly decide, like, do you want to continue doing this or no? So, like, you have more time if you want to.
I'm
okay.
Six.
So if you're in favor of, like, moving on the agenda, raise your hand.
In favor of going forward?
Yeah, like, we're done discussing this. Like, raise it high. And if you're opposed, as in you're ready to move on.
No,
as in
we want to
continue.
Yeah.
Continue.
Either way, we can close the speakers list so that it makes me feel better.
Okay, so then we're going to be, not everyone voted. Okay.
May I ask a simple question? That is, what's the result of what we do now?
So I'm just like, if I'm just.
No, trying. I don't mean that. I mean, what are we headed towards here?
The rest of the agenda.
In this particular estimate, what are we trying to accomplish now? Are we formulating a resolution?
No, this is just like deciding whether or not we
an
want
information
to amend
session?
The agenda. Like whether or not. We want
an information session. Is this all this is? Because that's I'm asking.
Yeah.
Front end of a 1 month period where people have to really make up their minds.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay. If you are done having this conversation and you're ready to move on the agenda, raise your hand.
Yeah, right.
So you're ready to close discussion.
Yes.
So no, keep it up. Marty, it's okay. And if you are not ready to move on, and you want to continue discussing this, raise your hand. Okay, and if you would like to abstain. All right, not everyone, I think everyone voted. Okay, so we're gonna continue discussing this. So we'll move on to the second speaker's list. Matt.
Thank you, I'll be brief. I'm going back to the code question, and the reason I brought it up is because for faculty and staff, I absolutely agree it's in their job duties. I mean, that's the distinction that what is really why some things are in the faculty handbook. When the code is written, that's what the distinction we make. My concern is when we're dealing with a graduate student or who, again, depending whether an employer or not, the topic, but an undergraduate grader, for instance, is clearly an undergrad. And if there's something to this policy, that traditionally and historically falls directly under the code. This is a larger conversation. And this is not your fault, but I brought this forward to Ms. Waymack on at least three occasions, Mr. Stetson, who I believe is also a member of the committee, as well as other members of this task force. It was assured repeatedly it would be discussed at length and there would be some discussion and dialogue with CJC. I'm disappointed very heavily. It didn't happen. Just in terms of on the policy, there's one line, it might be hearing board. That's not necessarily what I'm looking for, and I just want to make sure you're aware of that.
Why isn't a grad student, I'm a TA, you're an undergrad in this course, and I change your grade, all right? And I'm doing this because it's in my, I can do it because I have this job. All right. Or even an undergraduate grader, I give you 100 on this program and CS, you know, whatever. So again, those are things, this stuff happens in the context of doing your job. I this seems unambiguous to me. But, you know, there's the code, you know, these things can come up in tenure cases, there's stuff over there, there are grievance procedures, there's all these different things, and Title IX procedures and so on. But again, as far as the code's concerned, I have to be persuaded that something isn't job-related that we're dealing with here, or made possible by you doing a job.
Just very briefly, the co-distinction historically has been, what is your primary affiliation with the university? Faculty and staff, it's an employant. Undergrad has always been student. Graduate students isn't there with the whole union thing, but that's been the distinction. What's your primary affiliation with the university? Is it employee or not? And that would determine whether the code applies. This is a much larger discussion, but I just wanted to ensure that's the distinction.
Richard.
So, and I'll be brief too. So, Charlie, these are just my thoughts on
sure.
this thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so the authority thing, I buy that. All the authority relationship, I think, is very good. That it should be disclosed, you know, preemptively, I think that's bad. So that's a violation of privacy and an individual.
Let me kind of just jump in. All right, so you're having a relationship with a graduate student in your field, and here comes a meeting that we're going to talk about all the first year students. You don't think your DGS should know about this?
That's right. You should recuse yourself voluntarily. If it's disclosed later, then you're in violation.
But wait, you walk out of the room when they're talking about your partner. I don't.
You just don't say anything. Look.
Okay, go on. Yeah.
The thing on undergraduates, I find that argument unbelievable, unsustainable. I mean, these are real people. They're making choices. I think this could be, you know, policed as well as anything else. The Rochester example you keep bringing in as a justification for why
an example.
Do this. Well, it sounded like a justification. I mean.
Okay, yeah.
So be careful with the way you do it. It sounded like a justification, but I find it unpersuasive. It's only one case. And I believe that these kinds of relationships are much more important because they're ethical and personal and so forth than one other institution.
Well, the Rochester case is used because it's a nearby university. It's probably the one that's played out the worst, but there are huge numbers of these cases. It's a new scene out there, right?
But it's part of a larger problem of avoiding litigation. We do all kinds of things that I think violate inhibitions on a proper academic and intellectual culture. And it sounds to me like it's litigation avoidance.
Okay.
Rena.
Yes, I would like to revisit my earlier question in that, you know, I'm very worried that there are a lot of layers between the affected in this disclosure mechanism between the affected parties and the 6.x office. And so in terms of, okay, looking at this chart, there is the intermediary that is the DGS, for example, right? So how do you, so maybe because, you know, I think that there's a lot of room for people to pass on the buck, right? So how do you enforce that the DGS actually reports everything to 6.x? And how do you enforce that the DGS enforce the recusal plan,
part of
for example.
The trade-off here is not to make this, if I put the more arrows I put in there, the less, it is a communication thing here. Everybody, there's clear communication between that. This is just an option because you may not be comfortable talking to your DGS. But everything, you know, you can draw lines this way, and if you read our policy, even the X office would make it known to the subordinate about resources that are available. Okay, so there are lots of lines not on this, what I call communication lines. Their absence is leading you to believe that there's some big gap here or a chance to for something not to be reported or disregarded. So there's a lot more that connections here than I think the slide shows. What's your number one worry?
That a faculty member reports to a chair, and the chair feels that, oh, there's no need to report to 6.x.
They have to.
So, but what's the penalty if they don't?
I haven't thought about that in a detail, but the policy is very clear about, in part six of the rough draft, it's very clear on who should know what. This person, you know, again, we have the two options here because, again, we want people to have options to, in terms of who they talk to, because it's a delicate issue and you want to have that choice. So so you're saying, you're looking at this saying, this doesn't solve the sweep under the rug problem.
Yeah. Unless the department is held accountable if there is, you know, yeah, I think so.
But, okay, so things can be brought to the 6X, you know, if in fact, you know, we're talking about TA support, and it's known that one professor is exhibiting favoritism, anybody can report that, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to establish behavior patterns that are free of bias, right? So anybody can say, all right, hey, or I can take the chair aside saying, hey, did you know X and Y, you know, that it was not right for this person to make a recommendation on that student's support because they're involved?
So I guess, again, like, so can I report, say, the chair of a department for not disclosing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's why you have to have something that's outside of not only departments and fields, but also outside of colleges. Right, because there are examples where deans will, again, quote, look the other way because it's not something they want to deal with for various reasons.
Okay.
That's the importance of having that box, the gray box.
Yeah, so, yeah, there are two more people on this because I just wanted to actually ask a kind of a follow-up question about that. So the enforcement seems like it's kind of, and the enforcement and the penalties for people who don't disclose kind of seem like that might be like a lot of the work that goes in, like, is involved in this. And so, like, I don't know if you guys haven't, like, started thinking about this yet, but it seems like it would be really important to think about the penalties for, like, faculty members and graduate students who do this and then, like, fail to disclose it. Like, what, like, would the faculty?
Again, you can't, you can't have a list of infractions and a list of penalties. They're different levels. So for example, if there was a failure to disclose, but there was no harm done, at no point was any kind of favoritism or bias exhibited, that's one thing. That can be locally resolved without involving anyone outside of the department or field. But if there was harm done, if there was discrimination or bias because of something happened because there was a failure to disclose, the DGS didn't know any better, if that's a discoverable, that's a pretty serious infraction.
Yeah. So, like, what happens? Like, does the faculty member lose their tenure?
Well, I mean, no, there's a whole range of things. I mean, that's the extreme point. You have suspensions for a limited amount of time. You can say, can't take on graduate students for this semester. You know, there are a lot of intermediate things. That's very important to have intermediate things. If you just have slap on the wrist and dismissal, tenure faculty will basically say they can do whatever they want because the dismissal of a tenure faculty member is very, very hard. So it's very important not to have a two-column table, but to indicate that there are intermediate things that can be done.
Okay, yeah, that was my question. Joe?
I guess my concern is if all the assemblies except for the faculty center, like, because that's what it seems like, just like looking at the UA today and who had concerns and who didn't. I'm just going to be blunt. Sorry. But if the faculty senate is saying, like, no, we don't want this, and all the other are like, yeah, and then the policy comes into place, I feel like there's going to be more concern around this because then faculty members aren't on board with this policy, and so they won't even do it. And so it puts students and it puts the subordinates more at risk because faculty are like, I don't care about this policy. See what they do to me. And I guess that's my concern. So if there's not consensus, like true consensus at this issue, then I think it's almost going to be more damaging. And that's my concern right now.
Well, we have to go through this exercise.
Yeah, yeah, obviously.
And there's an education job that's been going on and now it gets more intense in these next four weeks. I hope people look at this. A, this is a rough draft. B, there are different sides of the coin. C, it's more than just two people and giving them the freedom and rights and stuff like that. There's a well-being of the whole community at stake. People have to be advised about all that stuff.
Charlie, I applaud what you're trying to do, and I'm not strongly opposed to it. I've got a couple of things I'd like to tweak around the edges, perhaps, and keep talking to you about. But I have a larger issue if we step back, because you guys purposely did not take on non-consensual
relationships at the start. And as you know, in our department, we had a big problem going on over a decade with a non-consensual predator, let me phrase it that way, that only slowly came to light. And to me, that's the bigger problem. And you've mentioned the University of Rochester issue a few times now, and it's clear that people in Day Hall are concerned about that. To be honest, I wasn't paying attention, but I've just been reading a little bit now while people are talking. And from what I'm reading online, the situation in the University of Rochester has a lot of parallel with the non-consensual problem that occurred in our department. And yep. So I'm not sure that anything you say there would have in any way addressed the problem at the University of Rochester. So I'd like to, you know, fine tweak some of your things, maybe be a little bit more flexible and less restrictive, while at the same time stepping back and looking at the harder issue of the really bad actors in our community.
Right. Yeah. So again, this is not about harassment, but this clearly, so something to say is reported. You know, when does coercion cross over to harassment? Okay, it's a very tricky thing.
Right.
And you don't even get started on this until it's been decided this is not a Title IX issue. If it is a Title IX issue, none of this applies. So there is an initial decision about that. It might go to the Title IX adjudication process. Maybe they decide this was consensual or whatever. But that borderline is right here. So,
it depends on the initial faculty member, in this case, coming forward and saying, I'm doing something, right? There's no other mechanism for bringing it into the process.
A student can, you know, we're trying to create a climate where people are more forthcoming with uncomfortable situations. So I'm a student. I don't like what's going on. There's been a sequence of things happening. I'm nervous. I contact the 6X office. There are people there who can give you, point you to resources to discuss things. And so one way of thinking about this is, pick your words, harassment prevention or conflict of interest prevention. And that is really important. I mean, to me, 95% of this is all about prevention. All right.
Sure.
Human nature is going to be out there. There are going to be bad actors out there. But the more educated the campus is about this, we don't know how to talk about this stuff. It's like when I did the emeritus stuff, that too was a taboo topic. This is also a topic we haven't had enough discussion about.
Yeah.
And if you have that discussion and if the whole community becomes knowledgeable about it, then you have peer pressure and a sense of something beyond yourself, that there's an environment here that we have to protect.
I agree with that, but I think broadening it beyond consensual and dealing with the harassment is important. All we're dealing with here are the people who we're making sure they're reporting the lines, and I'm more worried about the people who don't even understand those lines are there.
That's right, yeah. Well, 6.4 is being revised as we speak. The connections between this and that have to be really spelled out, and that's a very big and important connection.
Okay, yeah.
So one thing that bothers me about this, Charlie, is third parties. So consensual relationships, third party doesn't know whether there is one or not, reports it, goes through the channels. It becomes, what you're doing is setting up a police state, in which the incentives for third parties to damage for jealousy, for whatever reason, have official channels through which they can express their hostility or their whatever it is. I think that's going to happen. And I think that's worse than the situation we have at the moment.
But we have, bias. You feel the same way about bias reporting.
No,
I can or hazing reporting. You feel
no, because those things, the way the investigations would uncover and so forth and talk about, would be different than uncovering a personal relationship.
It's all about conflict of interest. If I feel another student has been given an advantage.
It's a consensual relationship, Charlie. It's not an evil thing.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about bias and favoritism.
Bias is another thing. This is not about bias. This is about consensual relationships. And it sets up an incentive in which people can charge other people with things. And I think it's a really bad idea.
Okay,
so I think that we should probably follow up with Charlie and talk with him a little bit more about this outside of the meeting, because it seems like not everyone is in the same place. But I think what is clear is that you've put a lot of work and thought into this. So I just want to thank you for that. Okay, so we spent a little bit more time on that than 20 minutes. So seeing as Risa is here, can I have a motion to amend the agenda to do the presentation from the hate speech work group?
Yes, so moved.
Second, any dissent? All right, seeing no dissent, we'll just jump right into the working group on hate speech and harassment update. Risa and Matt, thank you very much for being here.
Is there any water?
Oh, water would be great. Alrighty. Okay, so I'll just launch into this. I apologize for the voice. I've been hoarse for the last 5 weeks, and I'm hoping someday I won't be hoarse anymore. But yeah. It's what you do. It's what happens to us here in Ithaca, right? Anyway, thanks, Matt. So I'm chairing the working group on hate speech and harassment, and Matt's an ex officio member of the group. And just in case you don't have the list of people who are actually on the working group for the CJC. Well, actually, it's the CJC's working group. Not everybody, of course, in the working group is from the CJC, but just to refresh your memory. So another faculty member on the group is Sumant Seth. Scott Grants is a staff member. Victoria Price is there from CJC and is a graduate slash professional member. And also, well, from that same category is Aaron L. Sabrut. Two undergraduate students who are on the working group, Carlton Riley and Travis Campbell. Cabell. I know Travis really well. Sorry, Travis, for doing that. So we have a really good working group, and I think as certainly everybody knows, it was a little bumpy getting the working group up and running. You know, we're still missing an employee member of the working group, but we haven't gotten another employee member. Scott Grants is terrific, but we decided to just kind of continue to go and move on ahead. So I know that you're going to have questions, so I'll try to simply be brief in terms of giving you our approach, and I'll ask Matt if he wants to fill in with anything as well. But you know the history of how the working group got started, you know, coming out of the incidents last year. And the concern with issues of hate speech and harassment and how to best address those issues. So I won't go into that history anymore. However, of course, we're right back to being on the heel, you know, we're right on the other side now of having had more incidents over the last weekend. And so it's certainly, you know, very much in our minds in a very immediate sense. If you're on the working group, it's in our minds all the time anyway. And I'm sure that, you know, those of you who are in this body also think about those issues as well. But now I think the community is really focused once again on the kind of concerns, fear, you know, issues that we're facing in a community that's supposed to be open and inclusive. And yet we're looking at racist speech as well as actual assaults, as well as the sexual assault that took place. So, you know, we anticipate, of course, that we'll be looking at those issues as well. But let me tell you the approach that we decided to take, and the we means the working group. We've met quite a few times, and it's a really excellent group. We have really productive discussions, and we're very much in sync with the approach that we want to use. And that is that we believe that community engagement is essential, not simply as a matter of procedure that we're adopting, but we believe that full active community engagement at every level of the work that we're doing is essential as a matter of substance. That we did not want to go with preconceived notions of what needed to be done to the campus code, if anything. or that, you know, there were certain things off limits, certain things that we wouldn't touch, certain things that we wanted to touch. Each of us, of course, on the working group has notions of priorities and what we'd like to see. But as a working group together, we are all committed to the notion that the community should be engaged as much as they wish to at every stage of this. And so that includes all our meetings, which are open, all of our public forums, which I'll give a little bit more information about in a moment, and those public forums, including not only information gathering, but also creation of proposals. We want the community involved in the creation as well as in commenting on those proposals, because we believe that, particularly in this context, that the best work will come out of this committee if it comes from the community up, rather than from the top down or simply presenting proposals to the community. We believe that that's essential. We don't know where we're going to end up, but we certainly believe that the community should be involved and that we should be responding to what we hear. So one of the things that we've done, and hopefully you have read the announcements that have gone up, is that we've created a series of public forums. And as I said in one of our groups, I know it's fora, but I think forum sounds less silly. And so I'm going to use forums. So we have a series of public forums, and the first one, and each of these, we're going to have two sessions to try to make it as available as possible for people who have different schedules. So we just had our first session of the first public forum this past Friday afternoon, and I thought it was really an excellent discussion. I learned from listening to people, all the working group members engaged with the people who came, and we took massive numbers of notes because we're not like taping things or anything like that, but we're taking notes so that we can compare our notes with each other. The second session of that first forum will be tomorrow from 12 to 2 p.m. in Willard Strait Hall, room 414. Certainly hope everybody can come, and or at least at the very least, please encourage other people to come. And we're calling this first public forum an information gathering forum. So tomorrow will be the second session of that first forum. And we've provided some guiding questions that we're asking people to think about in terms of the purpose of the forum, but it's not constraining anybody from saying anything else. And in particular, one of the things we did is to provide some background material on the campus code and other Cornell policies that we wanted people to kind of have in mind as they're thinking about these issues. But in particular, we wanted to hear from people about their experiences that they've had or what they've observed in terms of incidents at Cornell, both on and off campus, dealing with hostile statements or actions that resulted in either the person speaking or others feeling intimidated, threatened, or otherwise unsafe. We would like to know from people, and we ask them to tell us how well they thought the incidents were being handled by the administration or the Cornell personnel. If they didn't think they were handled well, we'd like to know how you would have liked to have them handled or addressed. We'd ask people to think about the question of whether they think the campus code provisions adequately cover such incidents and whether there were any problems in the way the campus code was enforced. And I think that those questions help to guide the discussion, and certainly to Marsh, I think should be an important discussion, as I said, right on the heels of what's just happened. The second forum, the two sessions will be after spring break. The first will be April 11th from 12 to 2. The next will be Friday, April 13th from 3 to 5. And that we're calling our workshopping forum to workshop ideas about changes to the campus code of conduct. Again, we have guidelines for questions. People can, you know, continue to bring in information. We always want to gather more information, but ideas for possible amendments to the code or policies, ways perhaps that the code as written should be interpreted, even if not amended, and other ways that perhaps Cornell could intervene to address problems of intimidation and harassment. And then the third public forum, we haven't set the dates yet. I anticipate those would be in about the third week of April, maybe the last week of April at the very latest. And that's when, after having done this kind of workshopping and then going back as a working group, we'll have more fully developed proposals. We're going to seek public comment at those forums and ask people to comment on the proposals that we put out there. But again, those proposals will come from the ground up. And then those proposals, as we develop, have developed them from the working group, will go, of course, to the CJC for its consideration. And we hope to get those to the CJC at the latest by early May. Now, before I talk about the timelines more, I want to also mention that we have a website where people can write in their comments. They can do it anonymously if they wish to. We continue to develop lists to develop to people who would like to be kept apprised of the issues. Again, before I go back to the timeline, I just want to mention some of the things that we're hearing in terms of themes from the forum I thought you'd be interested in. One is the issue of that people were raising, that we're hearing again and again in the last forum, were issues of transparency and accountability. And the question of whether Cornell administration is transparent and informative enough about incidents that happen, not only to send something out and say we're very concerned about it, but to also follow up with further information so things don't just sort of go into the ether and we never hear about them again. We heard about some incidents, for example, in Donlan Hall of racist statements being written on a whiteboard there, and then frustration from people saying we didn't ever hear about what happened. Not that people want to, you know, violate FERPA or something like that. They recognize that names of people may not be available, but to know what has happened, what actions are being taken. We also talked about issues of ways perhaps to think about connecting up the different parts, different offices at Cornell that deal with these kinds of issues, bias and racism, sexism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, et cetera, rather than, you know, having those sort of ongoing challenges of siloing different groups. There we had discussions about protests and making sure to have a full right to protest on campus, as well as the questions of how, what are the appropriate lines for drawing between protected speech and speech that can be limited. For example, speech that includes not only explicit threats, but questions about implicit threats that could be part of limitations on speech and prohibitions on speech, and go into our thinking about harassment and how to define those questions. There was a lot of questions that I thought were very good, questions about education and training, not only education of students, but there were graduate students who were saying when they teach, they would like to know more about how to handle issues that come up in classes. And certainly I think faculty could benefit from that. And then just generally, there was a real desire to have close examination and analysis of incidents when they happen, and to really engage the community in discussions rather than just simply getting sort of missives about them. Okay, let me just talk about this timeline because I imagine people may have some questions about that. Since we plan on getting proposals to the CJC this semester, but it'll be late in the semester in May, we anticipate that the CJC will be engaged in its own public comment and consideration, but it certainly is highly unlikely, too impossible to imagine that will happen this semester. So the final work by the CJC, we anticipate will be in the fall semester of 2018 and then come to the University Assembly, because of course the CJC has to do its due diligence on any proposals that we give to it. There may be some people who find that frustrating. I mean, nobody would like things to go on longer than they need to. But one of the things that I heard from one of the first things I heard from the working group when we got together, and I said, well, I think there's some pressure that we should act quickly, that there, you know, people would like to see this quickly. There was a resounding, resounding response of, no, we do not want to be rushed. We felt that it was too much of a rush when there was an attempt last semester to, you know, move things along very quickly, even though those attempts were done in good faith. They were viewed as trying to shut down community engagement. So we want to do it right. We just don't want to do it fast in a way that's not going to move us forward. And we think that taking the time is part of that inclusive process that we hope will also help to contribute to the inclusiveness that we'd like to have in the environment overall on campus. Okay. Did you want to add?
I just wanted to add two brief points. One, I just wanted to thank Arisa for all her hard work. She's been an absolute pleasure to work with, and I know the entire CDC appreciates you stepping up to really handle this. Anyone who looks at our email knows plenty of emails in the wee hours of the morning when we're planning and scheduling, especially trying to make sure we handle the logistics of running all of this. So I just want to say I personally greatly appreciate it. I know the committee does as well.
Thank you.
And just for members of the Assembly, full details of this work will also be included in my annual report, which is filed with the Assembly at the end of this academic year. So we're happy to answer questions, but just there will be that annual report coming out towards the end of the year.
Okay.
Okay. Great question. So if you want to be on the cut, yeah. So first is Bob, then Charlie, then Marty.
Thank you, Risa, for your efforts here, which I understand, I appreciate. And I understand your statement of not wanting to be rushed and getting full engagement, and I also do agree that things were handled poorly in the fall. But you know, I personally feel that the University Assembly has an obligation to do something before this academic year finishes out, basically within the next 6 to 7 weeks, and your schedule would have us putting things off until probably November or something next year. You know, I think the community needs more closure sooner, even if we're
possibly October. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think November may be a little stretching it a little.
Okay, well, I think we need to do something by May. Let me phrase it that way. I will support trying to get the University Assembly to take some position on it in May, even if that means that we move ahead faster than what you're doing, because I think to wait a full year with the University Assembly not passing any resolution other than to take it under study and advisement, which is all we've done so far, just puts us in a really bad light. So I would hope we could move faster. I understand your scheduling constraints, but at the very least, we should figure out how to work in parallel with that so that we're not stepping on your toes should we feel it necessary to make some sort of public statement, which I think the Assembly owes to the community.
Can I respond?
Yes.
I don't know how you work this.
Yeah.
Couple things. You know, I mean, I think that the University Assembly could pass something in support of what we're doing. You know, I mean, it's up to you to figure out what you want to pass. I don't know. It would certainly surprise me if you passed something that amended the campus code at this point, given that the CJC wouldn't have the chance to look at it. But I also, and I think that also that the University Assembly would be in a good light if you, if your concern is being in a bad light, I think you'd be in a very good light if the University Assembly found some way to support the work that's being done and to, you know, send something out to the public. But that's up to you to figure out what to do. But the specific thing I want to mention is that, as you all know, there's a presidential task force that is working. And we are, we meaning the working group and the CJC, we believe that we should not just simply look at the presidential task force as some sort of disconnected parallel universe that's occurring, and we're just doing our work. It would seem absurd. And in fact, somebody raised that at the forum, somebody who attended the forum, who said, well, I don't quite understand why is there a presidential task force at the same time that there's this working group? Aren't you both doing the same thing? And tell you the truth, I actually had that same question when the task force was created. But there is a presidential task force. And so what we've decided to do in the CGC and the working group is to view the presidential task force as another place to get information. Because certainly one of the subcommittees there is working on issues of speech and harassment and environment, you know, climate. And so my understanding is that that task force is not going to have anything produced before May. And we would like to not simply say, well, we'll just ignore what you're doing. Rather, the kind of timeline that we are on is consistent with getting information from the task force and being able to incorporate that into what we do. Otherwise, it just does seem like there's a real disconnect between the two.
Charlie.
Yeah, so I just want to echo the timeline thing with Bob, because there was a back in September or whenever there was another timeline, which is December, right? And that we sort of promised the community we're doing something. I know you spoke against that timeline, but I would have been very relaxed about that waypoint as long as you see some sense of forward motion. In other words, people can say,
okay, you didn't get to that thing you promised, but boy, you know, I see forward motion and whatever. And so if we go through this semester into the fall, somehow, I don't know how, you know, there has to be some sense of forward motion. So anyway, that's how I agree with Bob. But here's the thing, and I brought it up with you recently and also here earlier, and it was all driven back maybe in October when I was talking to a student from the Black Law student group, and they actually had pros. You know, say, not saying this is the best thing, but hey, this is our first crack at what the code might look like. And then I thought, well, why don't we get that out there? And then, you know, this talking very simply, you know, you have strict First Amendment, strict constructionists, and people are more liberal. Why don't you just show us five different possibilities along the way? That's about educating the community. It's not about foregone conclusions or that we endorse stuff. So I don't see the reticence that I've seen since the fall for just getting pros out there. The way it looks like we're headed is we aren't, you know, we'll finally see pros and then be asked very quickly to vote on something. So again, I don't understand, and maybe you can explain, why is it so hard? Why the reticence and just showing sample pros from one extreme to the other so we can at least see that and then form our own opinions? You feel that that's, you know, that we're tilting the table or the, explain why you're reticent to do that. That's what
Charlie, I appreciate that. And something that was brought up, and I think when we talked in the fall a little bit, we the original December time, we held the forum October 27th, and we did something very similar to that. Here's some buckets of ideas, here's some draft language, and we were, to put it mildly, lambasted by the crowd and people who, by individuals, people from the Black Law Society. They all said they felt like we were moving so quickly that they hadn't been consulted in even how the approach was, and that created a resonance. I mean, and I think to Bob's point, I completely agree. I wish it would have gone faster, but we've hit. I mean, I mentioned this assembly before. I'm calling it the Goldilocks principle. I've had people saying we're moving too fast. People saying we're too slow. I have people on the work, or as a member of the working group, who's from the Black Law Association. The first words out of his mouth were, "We can't do this semester. We need to slow down and do it and take our time." But I can't necessarily. I mean, I completely agree.
Isn't this education? This not. I'm not passing judgment about anything. I mean, what it seems you're saying is that we as a campus can't talk about this stuff. We're not ready to talk. That's how I conclude this. We can't even put out samples objectively. And talking, we can't do that because we're not ready. Is that what we're saying about the campus?
Can I respond?
Yeah, go for it.
I thought I explained myself, but let me try it again. We could do that. We chose not to. And the reason that we chose not to, and that approach I think can work in some instances. It's not, I'm saying like never do that. But in this instance, given what Matt said in terms of the response that we got from the community, who we believe we need to be responsive to, as well as our own thinking on the working group. And there was a real consensus in the group around this. It wasn't just like two people, three, you know, it was the consensus that the education that's taking place is not just simply us educating the community. We want to be educated by the community. We are not so well positioned to know everything, and I think that there's a certain level of arrogance to any of us thinking that what we can just put out there will be the possibilities for people to be educated about, and then they can respond to them. In fact, I was educated at this forum in ways that when I heard it, I said, well, of course that makes sense, but I hadn't thought of it in those terms. For example, when one of the Black students who was present talked about the incident that occurred with the racial slur on a whiteboard in Donlin Hall, I think it was on the sixth floor. And that student said, look, there's like 10 students of color, 10 Black students in Donlin. When that happens, it's personal. It feels targeting. I feel targeted. It's not just simply, oh, it's a racial slur someplace and it's out there in the world. But if you're one of a few people in a large group of people and you are the targeted group, it's personal, that it is actually a threat, that you feel it's a threat in a way that's direct. And I thought, well, of course that's true. I hadn't thought of it in exactly that way. And that wasn't the only incident that people were talking about or the things that people were talking about in terms of things that they wanted to learn about or have action taken about. And so I believe the education goes both ways. And I absolutely believe that the inclusiveness that we say we're committed to needs to be done in practice. We are practicing an inclusiveness here. And the reason we're here now, in terms of this timing as opposed to earlier, is not because people did a bad job last semester. I don't think that it was a bad job done. There were problems with putting the working group together. They were unavoidable. Some of them came from the constituent groups not giving us the names of people, including this faculty. And others came from unavoidable situations. So it happens. It happened. I don't see any reason to dwell on that. It's too bad that we're not earlier. But I think we're doing good work. You said you want mileposts, you want progress. I just told you we've made progress now, and we're going to make progress because we plan on having proposals that we can give to the CJC by the end of the semester. I don't know how you couldn't call that progress. It's just not as fast as you want.
Marty.
Yeah, I think we're talking about two, probably more than that, if you want to get nuanced about it, levels. I think we're talking about getting a sense of what is tolerable behavior in a community. A statement of principle that comes from leadership. And by that, I don't mean the leadership of the Codes and Judicial Committee. I'm going to talk about the second side, the second level. The first level is that, and I'll come back to it in a second. The second is getting legislation out, putting together a code, which means putting together something that's defensible. Now, you said that the black student lawyers had I asked for that. I didn't get it. It'd be nice if we want to put it out. It's wonderful. It's one example of what stuff is, but it's not something that can immediately go into practice. What can go into practice, however, is, coming back to the first, a unified statement by the leadership of the university that certain things are intolerable behaviors. For example, otherwise things get left to, oh, well, it's just locker room talk, or, oh, well, that's just boys will be boys. My point is, you have to get principles out to the university that this is the way you behave in a civilized society. And we have lots of examples how not to behave in our leadership around the country. And it's we're at a really important time in this country's history. And if universities can't make simple statements from the leadership, which means deans of faculty, which means provosts, which means the president, and they can be coordinated with leadership in the Codes and Judicial Committee, but they won't have the kind of, what's the right word? They won't have the kind of meticulous needs for, getting things that'll go past the constitutional muster. And that's what you're working on, I expect. You're not working on a statement that this is unacceptable behavior. But why isn't there a statement of that sort that comes out as a unified leadership saying, we won't tolerate these things, and we're getting a policy together that says it was, but that will take a certain amount of deliberative time. So I don't think you should accuse people that are trying to do things the right way for legislation of being too slow. What I think we should accuse is leadership. And we did this with the fraternities at the same time. Why the heck can't the fraternities come out and say, this is unacceptable behavior? We set a standard. We are learning ethical behavior for a community. Why can't they say that? Because there's a tradition of whatever, secrecy or whatever. It has nothing to do with rights and stuff like that. Those things might be legislation. You can't take somebody and jeopardize their lives and stuff like that. But a simple statement about what's appropriate behavior on the campus. So I would suggest that if we want to make a statement before the end of May, we should get all the leadership together. And you can contribute to it in general terms to say, this is the guidelines, and we're working on the specific policies and legislation, which will take more time because they have to be done in ways that get down. I mean, a constitution took a while to write, you know? So that's what I suggest. And I'd like your response to that, Charlie.
I had a very simple thing here, which is how to educate the campus. And I just, you know, I just have a different view. That's all. It was simply, I don't want to stick to the issue. It's all, to me, the central thing is you're going to write code, right? That's your last, that's the goal. Or we don't. Either we change the code or we don't. So I'd like to begin thinking about what changes would look like. That's all.
Well, sure, we can do that easily enough. Get out two or three different possibilities. But the point is, if you want something that'll have purchase in the community, it won't be here are our five different possibilities for legislation, because those are things we could talk about for a long time. What will have purchase in the community is to have a unified statement by the leadership, which says this is tolerable behavior, this is intolerable behavior, and we want a university to be founded on the tolerable behavior.
Again, I like going. I go from the concrete to the general. I just, you know, in a very harmless classroom sense, I'm proposing, you know, five things that we can talk about. It's not like these are it. You have a workshop and someone points out that these are flawed, and then you figure out something different. Again, I just like saying things concrete. That's all my suggestion is about.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm making a different suggestion.
Yeah.
I'm suggesting that we actually do that, and that we direct the leadership of the university to do it. Just the same way as I would like to direct the leadership of the fraternities to come out with a statement of principle. And if you want something, if you want a resolution to that effect, I would say that. I think it's time for the leadership to stand the ground and to lay out certain basic fundamental rights about speech, about other things that they think are enforceable and can be put together, but that they think are just on the baselines. Every person, every study, for example, is one of those. Okay, but let's have the equivalent in this area.
Yeah. Okay. Joe.
Yeah, Marty, I really want to agree with you there. I think one of the most intolerable things that I saw was the response to the most recent College Town incident, where three students were assaulted, and I was disheartened because I am a resident advisor on that building right next to it, and I had students just breaking down, thinking that they were unsafe. And all I had to tell those students, well, presidential task force is on it, when the email came out. And I thought that was, you know, there's no way to comprehend what happened. But I want to kind of dispel the notion that the campus is not educated on this issue, because I find that is completely false. I have undergraduate students who are biologists understanding speech law. There are students who devote time this is not even in their field of expertise. And I think that's completely ridiculous. If you are a student on this campus, your safety, first and foremost, should be taken care of by the university. And right now the university fails to do that for a lot of students. I think that's completely disgusting. And I think even more so, what is bothersome is that students should not have to be the solution makers to everything. And even when they are the solution makers, they're not listened to, because it's not an administrator who's coming up with the solution. That's what's frustrating. So I really want to applaud you on the radical inclusiveness that that the group is taking, because I went to the forum and it was a conversation. It was really truly a community conversation. And I think the approach, I was a critic of the approach last semester. The approach this semester is, I just think, absolutely perfect. I think I see it, it feels different, and it's right. And I think the way it's being built as the bottom-up approach is the best way. Is it the fastest? Is it as fast as I was like? No, but, you know, I don't usually get what I like. So I think this is the best that's going on. And I think building the policy from the bottom up and not having us go A through E, like we get to pick which one we like, A through E, I think that's stupid. I think if we truly do the way that you're working, and if we just can constantly support that as an assembly, then we're going to get the best policy. But I want to also bring out a couple things that you're saying, because it's more than the code. It's more than language that's being coming from. And so I think any tangible products that you see from this working group, if they can be communicated to us, I think we can really start acting on them, because I saw more than just campus code of conduct language.
Just on that really briefly. I had some people say there's a binary, oh, amend the code, not amend the code. There's a lot, like, working groups looking at the full spectrum of options, whether that be looking at enforcement, sending recommendations off to other bodies. So, I mean, there is a lot of options there. But I mean, I think also, I mean, I feel like Charlie's getting a lot of heat for a suggestion. We're happy. I mean, this suggestion we're happy to hear, and that we want the input, we want the opinions, and we just had the consensual relationship policy. You need discussion. You need people to say an idea, and if it doesn't, it's not what we go with. That's okay. But I just want to make sure. I mean, I personally appreciate Charlie saying that suggestion because it's just good to at least have that discussion because that's how you get a better solution. Mm-hmm. But I think we're on a good path, and I appreciate the sentiments. Mm-hmm.
So I just want to note the time. So technically the meeting is over and we haven't done our committee reports or our five resolutions.
We'll extend by 10 minutes.
So we got
motion to extend by half an hour, right?
Okay, there's a motion to extend by half an hour. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. Okay, so now we'll vote on that. If you are in favor of extending the meeting
Point of information, does anyone have to leave? We're two above quorum, so people start leaving. It doesn't matter who we extend to.
Yeah, that's a fair point. No one is.
6:30.
Okay, so if you're in favor of extending the meeting by half an hour, raise your hand or placard. All right, the meeting has been extended to 6:30. Excellent. So with that, we can. Did you want to add something? I'm sorry. Yeah, I cut you off.
Yeah, no, you didn't. I didn't speak, so you couldn't have cut me off.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't even let you speak.
I gave you a chance. Yeah. All right. I really appreciate this discussion and hearing everything. And I want to point out that very quickly we are getting to proposals because right after the spring break, you know, we have an April 11th and an April 13th session for the second forum. We're calling it a workshopping forum. And so this is the perfect place for different groups to bring in ideas. And certainly the working group is meeting prior to that. We're going to be doing a lot of meeting and taking what we've heard and starting to build ideas for proposals. And again, as I said, all those meetings are open. So in a very short period of time, i.e. a very short period of time, like a couple of weeks, we are going to be starting that process of putting together ideas from what we've heard. And so, you know, I think that'll be very good move forward in that public forum number two, because we really wanted to then have things on the table for people to work from and to do that kind of quote workshopping on. And I also want to echo what Matt and Joe both said, which is that, you know, we're hearing about things that go beyond strictly campus code language. And so we anticipate that we may well have suggestions for ways that other Cornell policies might be addressed. Whether we can address them or not is another thing, but we hope that that can be a positive contribution to the discussion on campus. And as Matt pointed out, it can also be about whether it's changing the code or not. It could be about interpreting the code, whether things should be added to the code, like interpretations, whether there should be more clarity about enforcement. There are lots of ways in which the language of the code could actually stay the same in many ways, but you have other sorts of additions to the code that would be helpful. And just one thing, Charlie, in terms of this idea of putting things out there initially, it does change the nature of the discussion, because what happens is that when you put some things out and you say, here are some options for us to discuss without having that information gathering first, it basically means everybody directs their comments to what's out there, even if it's not intended to be limiting. And so, you know, in fact, I do think there's a real difference, and I don't know, I appreciate just all the input that I'm hearing. I'm taking notes from what you're saying.
Richard.
So I went to the first open forum. I'm not a member of the working group. There were 16 people, 9 of them from the working group, the UA, or the CJC, and there were 7 from the community. And there was some rotation, but not much. So it was very open. Reese did a wonderful job of eliciting comments from the field and so forth. That one of the things that strikes me about the conversation there was they do not, many of the comments, probably most of them, went beyond or in different ways from what we see as the hate speech sections of the code. Some of them, for example, required courses on sensitivity to issues. Some of them were controls or regulation of curriculum taught in classes. There were a number of other things that were about advising and other kinds. These things, I mean, these things are all outside of the specific mission, but they also suggest, and this is the education part, I mean, part of the education is there's a code, and this is what we're working on. And then the other part is the bottom up. You know, these were the community concerns that originally got this thing going. And so it's not easy to relate those community concerns to issues in the code. It is difficult. And I think Reese is exactly right. But one of the things, just the turnout should tell us that we have time to do this right. So this conversation, and Reese is, I'm going to repeat it again. Maybe other people have said it, but I watched from the back. I said nothing. I just watched from the back and observed this thing. She did a really splendid job of getting this going and having people interact. And it was really revealing for that reason. Mm-hmm. We were able to see all of these things. It is, Charlie's right, it doesn't immediately result in a code language. But boy, it's very difficult to see how to relate these things. Anyway, that was my call. I'm disturbed by some of these things about required courses and controls on curriculum and so that bothers me a lot, but it'll always bother me. So I'll just say that. But knowing that those concerns were there is an important thing to do.
Did you have something you wanted to add? Or, I mean, it didn't seem like there was a question there, just kind of a comment. So, yeah, I think it was a good comment. Chris?
Oh, I think one thing to keep in mind as we pursue community engagement is that it seems community engagement, I'm expecting, or in the past, has always been very high, like strong after events of sexual assault and racist incidents. But it seems that this process is going to be a very long-term process. And it's important to find a way to generate community interest and get more community input at the meetings, even when they're like weeks or months removed from the incidents. Because I was at the meeting on Friday, right before the racist attack happened that evening. And there were, I don't know, max 7 or 8 people there at the height of it. And I think it's important to get more input. I don't know why more people didn't show up. I don't know if it was something to do with publicity or because people just don't feel as strongly about it or because people don't know exactly what the working group is doing. But I guess just finding ways to get more people in the room to drive that community engagement, I think it's a very good objective. It's one recommendation.
Absolutely. Just a note, I personally sent notice out to listservs that have, if I'm correct, an aggregate of about 2,500 people with a note to please share. I know the rest of the working group was, I asked them, please share it widely. I've been working with our colleagues on constituent assemblies to get things out. Just in terms of, I mean, for context, the working group, we were 88% staffed around the beginning or middle of February. And we've been, ever since then, the working group's been meeting weekly. I mean, they're meeting in concert and as aggressively as the CJC is meeting. And it's in terms of getting room assignments has been difficult, getting logistics has been difficult, but we have been doing, I mean, that's why I've been stepping up recently. I mean, I'm not kidding. We are emailing back and forth in the wee hours of the morning.
Yeah, I'm not questioning your work at all.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. No. And I appreciate that. And I'm just trying to make sure that somebody's aware. I agree. And I had a conversation with the university fire marshal before this meeting because we're expecting our rooms tomorrow may be full because of what happened recently, unfortunately. But
yeah, I mean, there's another forum tomorrow.
I know.
So. Yeah, I'll bet you. I would expect that attendance might be higher.
And please feel free. I sent the email, the invitation to the listserv. Please feel free to share it with everyone and anyone.
Yeah, Rena.
Yeah, thank you so much for your hard work. So I am planning to come tomorrow to the forum. I was not able to come to the one on Friday. So, like, I guess piggybacking on Chris's comment. I don't know if the group has discussed this. I have mentioned this briefly to Matt, but maybe another way to generate sort of like more comments is maybe when you're doing workshopping or during the public forum period, public response period, maybe you can visit and meet with groups, you know, going out instead of asking people to come to you at the public forum. I think that's a strategy that you could discuss with the group.
We'll move on to the second speaker's list, Bob.
First, I wasn't meaning to criticize the slowness with which you're trying to review the code. I appreciate that it takes a lot of time. I think what I was trying to articulate is that the code, in my mind, is a small part of this. It wouldn't surprise me in the end if you recommend not changing the code at all, other than its interpretation. But I think in the meanwhile, the educational part and the leadership part, people speaking up, I mean, it is appalling when students are confronted with racist epitaphs on whiteboards in their dorm. And I think we as a community should be saying, I think the university is somebody should be saying that. So that's my frustration, is that I don't want to spend a whole year and a half to get your report through for us to come back and go, oh, yeah, that's wrong. Now, it's against the details of the code. I honestly don't know, but it's wrong in an academic community, and I think we should simply be saying that somehow before the semester's out. So that's where I'm really coming from. And I applaud your efforts to reach out to the community with your various meetings. I missed the last one, and I'm going to miss the next one. It's a busy time of year with job interviews and teaching schedules and things, right? I don't know what
tell me about
you
it.
Can do, but no, I know. I know. I mean, it's a fact of life, but that means you turn out to likely to remain low. I don't know if doing one in the evening or something would be helpful. I know there are problems with that, too.
Well, we talked about that, the unlikelihood of students, coming in the evening. We tried to do the midday stuff.
I hear you.
There's no problem.
I'm sorry, I haven't been able to come, and I'm not likely to, given the current schedule.
Yeah, but it's
just not a criticism.
Yeah, yeah, but we had a really high-quality discussion. I mean, it really was a conversation.
Yeah. I'm Marty.
Thank you.
Yeah,
it's just a small point. I take your point that that leadership coming out with a statement is important. Obviously, I was suggesting it's good to hear somebody else is interested in it. I would suggest that there's a sense of the body, not a resolution, that maybe it can be your purpose. I know you've got lots of stuff to do, but on a global super level, you approach the presidential task force and you get some kind of appeal together to leadership, central leadership of the university, to make a thorough statement, not infringing rights or anything like that, about the university climate. That's sort of basic. That, no more locker room speech, no more racial epithets, no more of this stuff. It's not in the spirit of what we're trying to do with any person, any study, except deviant behavior. I suppose that's a study. But, what's frustrating is to not have that thing right out on the table. Then you work on the legislation that says for what people do, or you can work on it coincidentally. But you got to say it. We got to say it over and over again, or else the dark forces will win.
Thank you. Just on that, actually, at the top of my notes, I have a senior minister that I've been working with has been standing offer to work with us, and I'd be happy to, next time I have the opportunity to speak to that individual, to bring that forward, because I think I completely agree. There's an opportunity to say, in essence, here's where we stand generally, and here's where we're going. The details take time, but we are, again, we condemn these in unequivocal terms and make sure that's incredibly clear from the leadership and ourselves as well. I mean, I think it's easy to.
Well, I would suggest the leadership means not just the president's office, which I think is very important, not just the public relations office, Joel or something like that, but I think it involves the faculty office. I think it involves the provost's office, involves all the senior leadership. I would, in fact, say that the board of trustees, that the chair of the board of trustees should be asked if he could ask that this is a matter of the campus climate, setting the bar, at least, and then working out the details thereafter. If that could be done before the end of the semester, I think that'd be an inspirational thing to do at Cornell.
Yeah. Okay. So that exhausts the speakers list. Thank you very much. Well, we can get in touch about kind of next steps regarding that after the meeting.
I'm happy to talk into this in detail if anyone wants. I know Risa and I, when we say we want your feedback, please let us know. We're happy to meet, chat, or do anything else to really ensure that everyone's on board. So thank you.
Yeah. Great. Thanks. Okay, Risa, feel free to stay if you want, but you don't have to like everyone else does. Okay, so we'll move on to the approval of the meeting minutes. First, we have the February 13th meeting minutes. So,
move or approve both passages.
Dissent.
Okay.
There's some errors that we want to correct. I can do these after. We want to table these and we can do it after the meeting. I know we're pressed on time.
Okay.
There's errors on both that I want to correct.
Does anyone object to letting Matt correct those errors?
And then voting on them.
Voting on them at the next meeting? No? Okay, Matt, then you can be in charge of correcting those.
I will send the corrections to Claire
and
Elena.
Great. Okay, so then we'll move on to the next item of business, which is the committee reports. I don't think.
Can we move to resolutions? I think if we get something out of this body, that would be wonderful.
Okay, sure. So then we can.
I'm sorry, I just
made a motion to amend the agenda to
second
down to business of the day. There's a second. Mm-hmm. Is there any dissent to amending the agenda and moving to business of the day? No? Okay, then we will go on to resolution 9, reinstating the budget planning committee. Joe, you have the floor.
Perfect. Well, it's not in the packet, so great. Which is what?
Okay. I have a comment about that.
Okay.
So, in the interest of preserving paper, the packets were very, very long and it was like over 700 pages as it is now. So, we thought it might be best to only print the new resolution. Which are the three that
was this Gina's idea?
I think it was I don't think it was necessarily just my idea.
Okay.
I mean
1-2 people in the office, so I appreciate the comments that I got after the meeting last time. I thought they were really great. Bob's, I think yours was a very it was to the composition of the committee, decreasing the size, which I think definitely would work better just because we're down. Yours was like, I forget exactly, from 17 to 7 members, something like that. I thought that was a great one to put on. However, I'm not going to be comfortable voting on at this meeting, speaking that there are no employees, and it would be the biggest effect to employees because of the fact that I was written with Linda, and in general, I think the employees had most of the concerns coming from it just because this was really to get equity from the other assemblies. But I reached out to which administrator, totally forget, it's buried in my inbox, never got a response back. So if the executive committee could help me get a more, I didn't get a response back for him. I guess I'm not important enough as an undergraduate to get an email response from him. But if the executive committee could help out with that, I think that would be great just to get a little more oomph, I guess. I guess I don't get to the top of his inbox these days. Oh, well. So I'm going to motion to table this one with the continuing comments that I had. Thank you so much.
Yeah, second. Okay, is there dissent to tabling? No, resolution 9 is tabled, and we can reach out to Paul Streeter.
Thank
also,
you.
Also, a point of privilege, in the future, could we be notified if resolutions aren't going to be included in our packet so we can know to bring old copies or electronic?
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like in the future, all old resolutions will no longer be printed, I guess.
Well, I guess point of privilege, either print them or let us know formally what's going on.
I will say that I have this message, and either they will all be printed from now on, or we'll let you know, but I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah,
I appreciate it, Terrell.
I know you're the messenger.
Yeah, so yeah, we don't shoot the messenger.
We will not shoot the messenger.
You don't do it, messengers, right?
Yeah, okay. But I agree with that. Let's move on to resolution number 10.
Yeah, so a quick update on this one. We were supposed to meet with leadership, with Ryan Lombardi, Vijay Pendekar, and all the other administrators that were made in this decision last Friday. Of course, we had the snow day, so that meeting got canceled. So we rescheduled to this Friday. So again, I'm going to table this one as well.
Second.
All right, there's been a motion to table and a second. Is there any dissent to tabling resolution 10? No. Okay, no dissent. Table. We'll move on to resolution 12, increasing access.
I'm going to motion to move resolution 14 before resolution 12 because the main sponsor of 12 and 13 can't come today. So if we don't come to those, we can do the next time. We'll be back as the person to draft.
So there's been a motion to move resolution 14 before resolution 12 and 13. Is there any dissent to that? No. Okay. Resolution 14, go. And
okay. So resolution 14 basically proposes certifying the Cornell Economics Museum, the CIP code 45.0603, which is a STEM certification. I know of a dozen other institutions, including five other Ivy League colleges, Ivy League universities, which have done so. And the reason why I believe it's possible at Cornell is because our curriculum is pretty much identical to that of many other peer institutions that have recertified their major under the STEM certification, and arguably even more requires more quantitative classes than some of them, such as Yale, which only requires, I think, statistics and calculus, whereas our UConn major requires two statistics classes. It also uses, you know, calculus and statistical methods in most of the 3,000 level and above classes. Students are also required to learn at least one statistical programming language, which is STATA. And the main motivation for actually drafting this resolution is that international graduates of a STEM degree are able to obtain work authorization for 3 years post-graduation, whereas graduates of the current economics program and other non-STEM majors can only work in the U.S. for 1 year post-graduation. What a longer work authorization means for international students is that they are more likely to be hired because employers can expect to keep them on for 3 years instead of just one. They also gain extended professional training in the U.S., obviously, and then they also gain additional opportunities to apply for the annual H-1B visa lottery for long-term work authorization, which happens once a year, and so they get more chances to apply to that. So I've already talked to the chair of the economics department, Larry Bloom, who's on board with this and currently working with the administration to make it happen, hopefully. But yeah, with that, I think I yield to any questions.
Okay, Marty.
Just a point of information.
Yeah.
Isn't this handled through the Faculty Senate? I mean, isn't this an educational policy issue?
Person 14.
Yeah. I mean, well, we would go through. We have the EPC, right?
Yeah. That's what I meant. Yeah, yeah. Why isn't that going to EPC? Is it here? Because it's a curricular matter.
Oh, so I was told. I think even by Dean Mello, this is for the dean. This is under the purview of the Dean of Arts and Sciences. So that's the office that's currently working on this.
No. I'm asking why the UA is doing it. Why isn't the EPC? And going to the Faculty Senate as a resolution comes to Faculty Senate, that it should, because it's curriculum.
Well, it's a one department thing. It's not a multi-college, it's economics, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And we deal with the economics department.
I don't know why it's here, but all I'm saying is it's not a Senate thing.
Maybe I can shed some light on this. So the Faculty Senate's Educational Policy Committee specifically deals only with cross-college academic
programs. No, I know that. I was on it for several years, but I was just wondering why it is. I mean, Charlie said EPC. I thought maybe EPC would sort of think about it because it involves STEM, which is more than just economics. It's also science, technology, engineering. So I may have implications for other departments. My simple question is, do we ever deal with academic programs like this directly?
We theoretically, I mean, we can make recommendations all the time. The Student Assembly made a recommendation on this, and it has an equal amount of purview over the matter.
Okay.
So that's, I mean, I can't, that's all I can speak.
I'm not against it. I think it is a terrific thing. I'm just curious of why it's here and not in the faculty area. Okay, are you moving a resolution?
Yeah, I mean, my rationale was that, I wanted to get input from faculty members because it's only passing the Student Assembly, and that by passing through the University Assembly, the signal of support from faculty and not just undergraduate students.
Matt.
So I think, first off, thank you. I appreciate this. I must confess, I share Marty's confusion as to why this is at the UA. I mean, in terms of it also, sounds like it went through the Infrastructure Committee, which also seems a little bit interesting to me.
No, it didn't go.
It didn't. Sure. Okay, never mind. That means I wasn't sure. But my question is really, I mean, to the why it's here. I mean, it seems like it sounds like it's already in process. It's being done in one college. I know the SA passed the resolution. Do we know? I mean, has Martha Pollack or President Pollack said yes or no? I mean, because to me, it's just if the administration has it, they're doing it, and they already have a resolution in the SA. Like, why are we? There's no reason for us to kind of pile on when it's still in process.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that they're doing anything. They said like they're going to explore and like they're just going to explore this opportunity and like gather information. So they're like. The process has started, but there's no like tangible action steps they've done yet. And what they'll have to do eventually is apply to the New York State Department of Education. We'll then evaluate the Cornell Economics curriculum against the federal regulations that govern the disbursement of CFP codes. But they haven't started that process yet. They're still like gathering information and figuring out, which bodies they have to go to.
So
how this can get approved.
So what does this resolution add? The SA one doesn't add.
It adds input from graduate students, faculty members, and employees. As employees, it doesn't really affect as much for graduate students and faculty. So that would be reasonable to pass with the UA because it gets input from more than just undergraduates.
I refer to that. I respectfully disagree, though. Thank you.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea, and I'm glad you brought it to our attention and your resolution's well written. But I have the same concerns. I don't really see it as the UA business. But let me ask, it's not an economic specific issue, is it? I mean, are there other STEM majors within the university where perhaps we should be more aggressively looking for this same issue, in which case perhaps it is a university assembly issue?
Yeah.
As written, I view this as between the economics department and their dean and whomever, it's not really us. You know?
And so the reason I made this so incredibly specific is because it's the strongest case to recertify economics currently, because so many other institutions have done it, and it meets the, like, I know that it meets the our curriculum meets the requirements of the code that is certified, the federal code. I know there's opportunities for other majors as well, but instead of putting everything into a package, I wanted to just go step by step and make some like incremental progress.
I'd rather see it as a sort of a study group of where else we should be pushing and assume that this is going to go ahead, and if not, people can help push it, right? That's my personal take. So it's not that I'm opposed to the idea, I just don't think the single case is UA.
Yes. So there's a couple other majors like AIM, for instance. And I know that psychology actually recently did recertify, and that was just an internal effort within the department. But I'm definitely looking to like other subjects that might be able to get into STEM certification. But economics is the one that has the strongest case, and that I know is definitely possible as of right now. Not aware of any other
possible in engineering majors, or
I mean, I think engineering is already uniformly STEM certified. Yeah.
Engineering is the E in STEM. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Richard, did you have anything you wanted to add on this resolution?
Only a question. So the last whereas, so Professor Bloom said of this initiative, it seems like something we should attend.
Yeah. So that's so. Yeah. And then since then, I think he said that he's like the associate chair of the economics department is now working with the office of the dean of arts and sciences to figure out the applications process.
So it's no longer seems like something they are attempting.
This was just quoted from an email that he sent me back when I drafted the resolution.
Okay. I mean, the resolution seems harmless to me. If it sounds like it's a sense of the UA that this go forward, it's hard to see what staff, for example, would care about it, or other departments and so forth and so on. So that Chris, but we do that all the time. We have a lot of resolutions that don't really touch on all the communities. So I would just pass it.
Okay, Matt.
I mean, should be clear. I think this is a good idea. I understand through the essay. Our econ program is at the level of STEM. I echo Bob's point that it's just in terms of me, it seems like this is so focused that if it's already in process, essence just saying we want it again without having some more information to me is just, I don't want to. I mean, chair governance, our authority really comes from the president will listen to us and will take our counsel. And if the president is in process and we're exploring it until such time as we have more information, or I think a more general, we found these other majors, or we want you to look generally at recertification, I think that's more in our purview. I mean, I agree it's harmless, but to me, the UA, we handle large cross-cutting issues that really, I mean, this one does affect multiple constituencies because it's a major and it's academics, but to me, it's because it's so narrow, I'm not necessarily sure it in its current form, it's necessarily something the UA is under our purview. I think it is a good idea, but I definitely agree with Bob's point that if we broadened it and said, let's do an investigation of multiple majors or some other suggestions, and then in general, I think that would be more of the UA's level. But I think in this case, we're tabling this so we can look at it further in more depth to try and figure out where we want to take it. So motion to table then.
Second.
Okay, there's been a motion to table. Is there any dissent to tabling?
So if we table, then it comes up at the next meeting, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, I think that's fair. Because if there's no progress on this until by next meeting, then I'd ask that we try to pass this. Just because it adds more weight to actually make this happen. But as of now.
Okay. Also, I want to note that the chair of the Faculty Senate, Van Loan, is quoted, and it's, I know it's, you're not the chair of the Faculty Senate.
Oh, on this thing.
Yeah.
I love your quote.
You got quoted in a resolution. Okay, so is there any dissent to tabling it? No? Okay, then it's tabled. Okay, so
Then we can go into resolution 12 and 13. Are
point
the,
of information.
Yeah.
Will the sponsors of these resolutions that you wanted to talk about them be here?
Yeah, I mean, I can present it without them. It's just like if there's any more detail. I think Joe is also.
Motion to go out of order and enter executive session. We're already at time again, and we have to get the JCC thing handled today.
I'll second that.
Yeah, let's do it next time.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, let's do it next time. This agenda has been quite interesting. We've been jumping around.
Could I dissent to that and motion to put Joe's committee update first about the tobacco referendum?
Oh, yeah.
I will throw mine in on.
No, actually, I mean, I think we ought to take some executive. We need an executive session to go through. If there's somebody who wants to leave at 6:30, we need
to. I need to leave at 6:30.
Okay.
Okay.
Then sure.
I'll email it to the assembly.
Okay, because if we lose one more person, then we lose quorum.
That was bad.
So, okay,
is
we're going to.
Part of our quorum?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, we're losing.
No.
We can lose two people.
So Charlie leaves one of those.
All right, let's do this quickly. So we're in executive session.
Charlie, stop the recorder.
Kind of executive session because the camera's still on and I don't know how to turn it off.
Run to Rel.
That much.
I can take care of that.
Double time to Rel.
Doesn't really matter. So we need to send somebody to the Judicial Codes Counselor Search Committee. We send one person to the committee. That person attends the meetings. I did it 2 years ago. It's a really great experience. It's pretty interesting.